Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And hello, everyone. Thank you for being with us again on another Sunday. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Today we're going to talk about executive actions and executive orders. Our guest today, Professor Rachel Potter. She's at the University of Virginia in the Department of Politics, where she's an assistant professor. Her research interests include American political institutions and regulation, public policy and administration, along with the influence of separation of powers on bureaucratic decision making. Dr. Potter received her PhD from the University of Michigan, and she's received multiple fellowships and grants and awards throughout her career. Before becoming a full-time political scientist, she worked for a number of governmental institutions, including the U.S. Government Accountability Office and the White House Office of Management and Budget. Her most recent book, Bending the Rules, Procedural Politicking in the Bureaucracy. Professor Potter, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. I'm excited to talk about executive action with you.
Well, I will say that not everyone can say that phrase. Many people can probably say that they're interested in learning about it and think that they want to know more. But I'm curious as to how many people are actually have their fire lit when you say tonight's discussion is executive orders. Versus how many people get up and leave the room.
I imagine that you're right. It's a very small subset of people, but I am one of those extreme weirdos that just loves thinking about how the president exercises political power. So I think there's a lot of nuances that get missed in media conversations about this. So hopefully we can disabuse people of some misconceptions that are out there.
And that's what I want to get to, because I think for many people in today's, I don't want to blame it on the media, but in today's world, what the only thing that you seem to hear about is the president signed another executive order, and whichever president you want to refer to, and then the number of people who synchronize executive order with executive action. So for the hour, I want you to teach me and answer questions and have a conversation to enlighten us with all your knowledge and background on the topic. And because while I may not be able to sit down for the hour and have brunch with you and provide much in the conversation, I can be the wall that you're throwing knowledge at. And that's what I want to do for the hour, because I think there's a lot more people out there who want to do it that way. So can we do that?
That sounds great. Let's do it.
So one of the first things, as I mentioned, I think for many people, the executive order and the executive action are the same thing, but that's not the truth.
No, these are different terms. And so let me step back and kind of give a little bit of context when we talk about the president doing something, right? So if we think about the president as a CEO of an organization, right, he's overseeing, he's a chief executive of the federal bureaucracy, which is 2 million people. And he's got to do a lot to manage that organization of 2 million people. So we think the president today wears a lot of hats. He might be considered a foreign policy diplomat, a moral leader, a negotiator with Congress, but he's also the chief executive of the executive branch. And so when we think about these actions, what they're mostly doing is telling that organization how to operate. And so you're asking the difference between the term executive order and executive action. I guess when I think about it, I think executive action is kind of a lay term. It's sort of an umbrella term that encompasses a whole suite of tools that the president as the chief executive has to manage the executive branch. So So an executive order is the number one thing that we hear about in the media. That's probably the most high profile of the suite of tools. And that's really when the president is telling a federal agency, here's what you have to do, right? I'm directing you to take a specific action. So these do not apply to you and I as private citizens. They're directed to the president's authority as the head of the executive branch. So let me give an example. Say a president wants to raise the minimum wage, which is something that President Biden is thinking about right now. He can't do that by executive order. He has to, if he wants to do an executive order related to the minimum wage, what he does instead is tell the federal agencies that they're federal contractors, when they hire contractors, that the minimum wage for those contracts with the executive branch will be raised, right? Because these don't apply broadly, I guess, to the American public. They apply to the bureaucracy itself. So that's an order, but there's also something called a memorandum, which is kind of like a step down, and that's maybe a little bit less visible, and it's a type of executive action. It, again, directs an agency, a part of the president's enterprise, like the EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency, or something like that, to take an action. President Obama's deferred action for childhood arrivals was actually a memorandum and not an order. That's often glossed over in the media. There's also presidential proclamations, which are acts the president takes, which are directed at the public, but are generally ceremonial in nature. So a president might declare National Military Spouse Day, which is celebrated in May, and President Reagan identified this through proclamation. So that's another way the president can have an executive action. And the final class is a signing statement. So these are statements the president signs that accompany a piece of legislation, and say, this is how I, as the chief executive, am going to have the executive branch implement this piece of legislation. And some of these can be controversial, but most of the time, these kinds of actions are pretty much an executive managing his or her organization. So we hear about the controversial ones, but many, many of these executive actions are pretty mundane and not the kind of thing that people listening to the radio want to hear about.
So You talk about the difference, but once an executive order, let's talk about some of the ones. Use an example that is not necessarily liked by the majority of Americans, or the majority isn't the best word here, but by a large sum of Americans. Are executive orders legally binding?
So, yes, they are legally binding. So when the president, this is a way the president can make law. Again, it's not law like changing the minimum wage for the entire U.S. population and every employer in America. It's generally circumscribed to this, again, power to oversee the executive branch, which is an important and critical power that has spillover effects. But these things are legally binding. They can be litigated in court. Are they actually constitutional, the individual action? But the actual question of, is the president allowed to do this? Yes. Time and again, courts have said presidents are allowed to take this action, and we have to follow them, or the government has to follow them when they're taken. So you asked for an example of a controversial action that has been done through executive order. Well, there's tons, right? We read about a lot of them. One that comes to mind immediately is thinking about President Trump's immigration bans that he issued at the start of his administration in 2017. These were very controversial. There were protests throughout the country in opposition to these orders. They were taken to court, and lower courts did strike those down initially. Eventually, President Trump came back through with a sort of scaled back version of that policy that was a presidential proclamation. So a different type of action, again, within his power as chief executive, that was controversial and led to a lot of debate and discussion about the role of presidential power.
So it sounds like the executive order can be law until proven otherwise, if the court says, no, you're wrong. So is an executive action just a threat?
So that's kind of a funny way of thinking about it. So executive action, again, is this umbrella term that includes executive orders, which are legally binding. And so are presidential memoranda, right? Something like a signing statement, it becomes a little bit questionable. What do you mean is this legally binding, right? It's just a statement about how the administration plans to implement a law. So it's not necessarily a question of, is this a threat? It's just a statement about how policy will be implemented. Understanding how this president wants policy to go. One thing that's kind of interesting about executive actions in general is just because the president signs them and they're legally binding doesn't mean they always happen, right? Any executive of any organization knows that when you tell a group of, 2 million disparate people, which is the people that work in the federal bureaucracy at the Environmental Protection Agency or the Food and Drug Administration or the Department of Defense, when you tell your subordinates to do something, they don't always do it. And so as scholars, we've noted that there have been executive orders that haven't been perfectly implemented the way the president wants them to, or that actually change policy in a meaningful way. Sometimes they're just rhetorical devices to get a president sort of a quick hit. And I did something. Look here. I promised in the campaign I was going to take action. Look, I took action.
I guess so. The difference between the executive order by the president and the legislative law by Congress. So legislative law by Congress can't be wiped out 4 years later with such ease. An executive order can?
Absolutely. So that's an important difference. So there's two important differences. One is, right, thinking about, again, I keep giving this example about the minimum wage. Recently, Congress has been in discussions on should we raise the federal minimum wage. That's something that Congress can do. It can require a private sector employer like UVA or Microsoft to raise the wages they pay their employees. The president cannot do that through executive action. He can only require that the employees of the federal government or their contractors be paid a certain wage. So there's a limitation to sort of the scope of what an executive action can ever cover. That's one important difference. And then you've hit on the second important difference, right, which is that laws passed by Congress can be only overturned by another law passed by Congress or, in theory, by the courts. But an executive order can be overturned by the next president. And we see a lot of that. We've seen a lot of that in the Biden administration, kind of revoking Trump executive actions. And that's pretty typical to have some amount of executive action revoked by the incoming president.
Was there a constitutional conception for an executive order, or were these added in as an amendment?
So there's no part of the Constitution that says that pertains to executive orders. If you go back and read the Constitution, which I have my presidency students do every semester, you can read Article 2. It's actually pretty short what the president's enumerated powers in the Constitution were. So there's no part of the Constitution that mentions executive orders or executive actions. This is a presidential power that has emerged over time. In sort of interpreting what the executive power is. So if you read the Constitution, what it says is the executive power is vested in the president. And over time, over 200 odd years, we've interpreted what that means to vest power in executive. And what we've done as a society, as a political set of political institutions, is endorsed over time this idea that presidents should have this power to do this, right? The courts have again and again reaffirmed the ability of the president to do this. And partly, like, why are we allowing this to happen? Why has the president done this? I think there's a great quote from journalist H.L. Mencken. He said, "No man would want to be president of the United States in strict accordance with the Constitution." Those powers enumerated there are pretty narrow. So So what we've done is seen that the power of the executive has grown over time. And in order to manage this sort of growing institution, the president has been amassed these powers.
Do you think, and I ask you this as an academic, not personally, do you think that the current use of executive orders and the presidency's powers are have evolved to where they are now in the manner that they were originally idealized by the founding fathers?
So that's a tough question to answer because, again, this wasn't in the Constitution, but it's emerged over time. But every president, or almost every president, every modern president uses executive orders. They're very routinized in today's political environment. But even George Washington had an executive order. Has the way they've been used changed so much? Yes, absolutely. So in the mid-century, we had a lot of presidents, a lot of executive orders, just an absolute explosion in the number of executive orders. But the reason for that was they were used for pretty mundane, like personnel matters, like allowing certain individuals to waive the mandatory retirement age. So those are things we mostly don't care about. Over time in the sort of modern presidency, we've seen this power evolve and to be used for presidents to do things that are really important, public policy items for their agenda, like Trump's immigration ban, or like a number of executive orders we've seen over time that expand the president's role in the sort of regulatory powers of the presidency. So they've expanded and changed over time in ways that presidents are using them more to accomplish policy goals than they were in earlier times.
Well, you mentioned earlier, again, our guest today is Professor Rachel Potter from UVA's Department of Politics. You mentioned earlier about there are other methods, the executive actions covers a variety of issues. The letters that can be written, such as rejoining the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Agreement that President Biden has already done, are some things just as simple as that?
Well, I mean, sometimes it is really that simple. That is the letter that Biden sent to have us rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. It was very short. And that is entirely within his power. So that's a separate class of presidential actions I didn't even mention, which is executive agreements. The fact that the president has the ability to negotiate with other countries and join agreements that don't have to be ratified, like formal treaties by the Senate. So that is another type of executive action. And sometimes it really is that simple. We want to be back in the Paris Climate Agreement. Boom, Biden writes the letter, we're back in. It doesn't have to be very complicated, although executive orders are typically put through a pretty rigorous scrub within the executive branch, a legal review, and then a review by all the relevant federal agency heads.
Our guest today, Professor Rachel Potter from UVA's Department of Politics, as we talk about executive orders. When we come back, I want to talk about how executive orders might have affected the three-branch system of government. So hang tight, and we'll be right back. And welcome back again. Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about executive orders, executive actions, with Professor Rachel Potter from UVA. Professor Potter, so if the executive branch of government is the phrase in flux and growing appropriate over the last decades or maybe even century, has it expanded and taken over powers of the other branches?
So this is a great question, and a question that a lot of scholars are thinking about and debating right now. If we kind of look at the executive branch since World War II, the amount of things it does have just grown tremendously. So let me give you a couple of examples. Medicare and Medicaid, these basic programs that are a huge part of our federal spending and a huge part of how Americans experience government, did not exist, right, until 1965. The number of people receiving Social Security and federal student loans to go to places like UVA has just exploded. So we have so many more things government is doing. We have the internet that needs to be regulated, and we need to have drinkable water. And we have an agency that was created in 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency, to do this. So my point is, like, the amount of things that the federal government is doing in 2021 is so different than it was doing in 1945. And we have hundreds of agencies at the federal level that oversee this. So the amount of spending and oversight and just things happening in the executive branch has grown tremendously. With that, we've seen a growth in presidential power, right, in terms of the number of regulations that the executive branch is making. The number of people has changed. It is a large organization of about 2 million or 4 million if you count the military in that. So that's happening in the executive branch right now. And the way that, because these demands have grown in the executive, the president's need to control and oversee this has also grown. And so we've seen a growth in presidential powers that accompanies this change in the way our society is governed.
So I, in doing my homework for today's show, I found where you had given testimony before the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress at the U.S. House of Representatives. And in that testimony, there's a discussion, and I quote this, "At the beginning of the 20th century, rulemaking was a relatively infrequent activity. However, today it is a routine part of the administrative state." So can you tell me the difference between rulemaking and lawmaking? Because lawmaking is legislature, or that's what we're taught in the early years of school.
Yeah, so we all know that sort of how a bill becomes a law part of government. And I think, right, if I could overhaul our civics lessons for elementary schoolers today, I'd amend that a little bit to say we have this 2 million person strong executive branch that's doing all those things I just mentioned, and they issue their own bit of law, or bit, it's a large body of law every year, which is called regulation. And there's a whole process that agencies follow, they go through, and it's often a multi-year process to create this body of law. And it is binding just as if Congress had passed law. So it's another way that the executive branch is making law that people, and these regulations, I should say, aren't like executive orders. They narrowly apply just to the executive branch. They can apply to individuals like you and me. And so if the agencies are required to stay within statutory authority, so they're a little bit circumscribed. But this is a really powerful way that our society is regulated by law, is from actually people like bureaucrats at the Environmental Protection Agency or at the Food and Drug Administration who make law for us, unelected members of those organizations.
Well, so if we're talking about the growth of the executive branch because of regulations that have been created because of the different departments that now fall under the executive branch, thanks to executive orders, has government in itself, and I don't want to make this too silly a question where people are listening and go, duh, but has government itself in the other branches expanded at a somewhat equal pace? Has the legislative branch grown at a somewhat equal pace? Has the judicial branch also expanded?
I don't think that's a simple or a duh question at all, because I think we have this understanding or this popular conception that we have big government and it means everything's expanding. But actually, we have the three branches that we all know about, right, from our civics and constitutional understanding. And what's happened is we've had this explosion in sort of what the executive branch does and what it has to do and how many people and things it's in charge of. At the same time, we still have the same number of members of Congress, right? We still, and those members of Congress, by the way, in recent decades have given themselves fewer staff members, right? So what we know from scholarship that looks at Congress is that that Congress itself has a lower staff capacity than it did 30 or 40 years ago. So fewer staff per member. The committee staff are also on the decline. And that also, if we look at these staff members, not only are there less of them, but they actually tend to be younger, right? So they're not like career staffers who have these like long traditions of experience in sort of doing the work of Congress. And then on top of that in Congress, what we've seen is there's also been a decline in the ability for them to have support resources, like a decline in research services available. There used to be a lot more services that members of Congress could call on to get backup support when they didn't understand an issue or they wanted to really investigate an issue in more depth. And what we've seen is that those have kind of gone away due to a lot of different reasons. So that's happening on the one hand, that members of Congress are sort of lower staffed and lower capacity. And at the same time, what we've known is that members of Congress are supposed to do a lot more with their time. So the average member of Congress spends at least 3 to 4 hours each day phone banking to raise money for their reelection campaign. 3 or 4 hours each day. Wow. And then they're traveling at the same time back to the district to get FaceTime with constituents. So we want a Congress that's able to oversee all this stuff that's happening in the executive branch. But actually what we've seen in recent decades is that Congress's ability to do this has dried up. Or not dried up, that's maybe not a good expression. It's just really declined in its ability to investigate and oversee the executive branch. And you mentioned the testimony that I gave before Congress. The reason that the House appointed that select committee is because they're exactly worried about this issue. How capable are they of doing the job that the modern government requires of them? And can they reform themselves in ways that make them better situated to do this? Because there's been a real concern that they're not as well situated as they could be.
Elsewhere in that testimony, again, our guest today, Professor Rachel Potter from UVA's Department of Politics, as we talk about executive orders, you talk about, I quote, inexorable increase in the size and scope of executive function over the past 40 years. So is this due strictly to the increasing number of departments that currently fall under the executive branch, and then therefore all the staff that goes with those departments? Or is this the president says, I'm going to do this, and no one questions it or no one stops it from happening, and so therefore it is seemingly written as having happened once, so it is now allowed to happen going forward?
So I interpret your question to kind of be like, why has this growth happened? Is this the president grabbing power, or is this like the sort of bad bureaucracy that we hear so much about that's sort of like taking power for itself? I think actually, I think about it quite differently, which is that look at our government. It, as I described, it's doing so much more. There's so much more demands for what society nowadays requires from our government. Right. We can just think about the COVID response and what that's been like and what that's required from the federal level, the kind of coordination. So there's so many more demands today than there were 40 years ago from what we need from government. So and how did that go to the executive and the bureaucracy? I think the answer is that Congress created this infrastructure. Right. They actually delegate power to the executive to say, hey, let's set up a federal emergency management agency, for example, that's ready and prepared if we have national emergencies like what we saw in Texas recently with the bad winter storms or with the coronavirus. Right? We need to have that capability and capacity to be ready to respond to these demands. And Congress recognizes that, but nor can they do it themselves. Right? They're not set up as a chamber that could respond to emergencies. We need this executive power. So I look at the structure of executive powers in some ways a necessity of what government in the 21st century requires is this action and this need for somebody to do this, and that somebody has been the executive branch.
We were talking at the beginning of the show about executive orders being legally binding, et cetera. Is there a punishment in any way for breaking an executive order that one citizen or one member of government may not believe in? I mean, you mentioned that out of 2,000 employees in one group may not, so that executive order may not come to full fruition, but if you're found to be intentionally breaking that executive order, whether employee, staff, regular citizen, is there a legal punishment?
I think it's the answer to that is kind of like any other type of law. Is there a legal punishment for speeding? Yes, absolutely, right? The question is whether it gets enforced, right? A policeman has to stop you. He or she has to give you a ticket, and then you have to pay the fine. It's the same with executive orders. So they are legally binding, and the executive is technically, according to the letter of the law, required to do what their chief tells them to do. Now, whether some recalcitrant bureaucrats in a specific agency decide they don't want to implement the president's action and they don't do it, well, it's kind of up to the president, or if there's some group that has legal standing to pursue that, to say this exhort order is not being implemented, to take it to the courts, or for the president, if it was, say, an agency head who said, I refuse to do what you want, to fire that person if he's so able to fire that agency head. Presidents generally have that ability, although it depends on the type of agency generally, whether they can do that. So, I think the speeding metaphor really helps understand the sort of legal enforcement mechanism. It takes someone to enforce it.
I have to tell you that I love the phrase recalcitrant bureaucrat. That put a smile on my face as we talk with Professor Rachel Potter about executive actions and executive orders. Professor, I want to talk for a while about policymaking by the office of the president, because executive orders and executive actions, if we go back, I don't know how far. I mean, I made a list here, and I don't want to get into it at the moment. I'll wait until after we take our next break. But it seems like depending on your age and your political party affiliation, that you can go back and start with some president who started signing executive orders that you didn't care for. Because it's amazing when you pull out your Google webpage and find out how far they went back. As you said, George Washington wrote executive orders. It's not anything that started happening in the 1990s or 2000s. But we have discussed the fact that, I guess, the seeming power growth of the executive branch. And another quote from your testimony, political polarization also magnifies the power of the executive branch. When Congress does not act, the executive often steps in. If that's the way to get work done, that seems unconstitutional. But again, I go back to my Schoolhouse Rock.
So the Constitution, obviously, as I mentioned, doesn't address executive order. It's something that's emerged. We have this conception that policy is only legitimate, right, if it is passed through Congress. That is, I think, because we're schooled in this way of understanding how law should be made. But that isn't how law is made today. And so I would kind of push back and say that doesn't seem constitutional, and say, well, literally over hundreds of years, our governing institutions have legitimated this and ruled it as constitutional. If we tried to understand presidential power from those little words in Article 2, we'd be out of luck because it's so short in terms of words.
All right, let's take our next break. We come back with Professor Rachel Potter, UVA's Department of Politics, as we talk about executive actions and orders. Professor, when we come back, can you read us Article 2?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, maybe it might be a little long. But.
Okay. Well, let's do that when we come back and get a feeling for what we keep referring to here. Hang tight, everybody. And here we are, Sunday morning wake-up call on a Sunday. Amazing how that lines up. As we're talking about executive actions, executive orders, how they work, the definition, how it's affected the three-branch system of government, things that I never knew, and hopefully you're learning as we go along with Professor Potter. Professor, you have mentioned Article 2 of the Constitution several times now. Now, you mentioned that it's rather long to read on air, but can you sort of read us a couple short pieces of it to give us an idea of the gist that is keeps being referred to?
Yes, absolutely. So this is the second part of the Constitution that I'm talking about, and it tells us who can be president. We know that the president shall hold a term of 4 years. That's in the Constitution. He's going to have a vice president. And then it stipulates the things like the Electoral College and how he will be selected, that he must be a natural-born citizen. But again, this is not like hundreds of pages of text, right? It's very few words. So I'm going to read you the two clauses that scholars really have focused on, and I'll tell you why, is because they're so short. So the first is the very first sentence of Article 2 of the Constitution. It says, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America." That's probably the most important sentence in the entire article. I'll read it again. "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America." Who knows what that means? I don't read that and have a deep understanding of what the executive power means. And the rest of the article doesn't tell us a lot about what it does. It tells us the president can choose agency heads who will be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So that's one important part of the article. And the second key part is this part. It says, "He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed." right? So it's telling us that Congress is going to pass laws and they're going to do all kinds of manner of things, and that the president, the executive, has to make sure that those laws actually get implemented. Now, if we go and read laws, which is a whole other can of worms, there's also a lot of inspecificity there, too, right? There's a lot of gray areas that it's just too hard, even in thousands of pages of text that some of these bills have, to specify all the things that need to happen. And so what's happened over time is that these terms have been interpreted, and the president's job over time is to make sure that these things happen, and that he's holding dear to that, right? And that's why we have an oath that the president takes at the inauguration, to swear that he's going to do these things in his interpretation of what the Constitution and the laws have been interpreted by the court since.
So the way I heard that, the first part was, the president can do what he wants if it isn't otherwise illegal, or the president is above the law if he's making sure that the laws are being otherwise followed. And I think that was one of the arguments that was being made by the previous administration, if I'm not incorrect, was the president's above the law.
So there's nothing in the Constitution that says the president either personally or is above the law, or as chief executive, not in his person or as chief executive, is above the law. It says that the president is supposed to implement the law, and often that requires this sort of interpretation of what the law actually is. And so it's not giving the president in any way a free pass, and executive orders really don't do that either. It's saying that the president is going to have to go out there and do his best within the statutory and constitutional framework that he is given to implement the law. When we think about that vesting clause, the vesting clause is giving him a broad, as you said incorrectly, right? It's giving him a broad interpretation to do things that, as long as it's not really kind of stipulated that you can't do this, presidents have really taken a lot of power from that and said, yeah, I probably I'm going to do this because there's no law or no constitutional requirement saying that I can't do it.
Right. It doesn't tell me I can't, so I can. So let me ask you this. Would a questionable or unwanted executive order, do you think that would lead Congress to action against it? Because one of your earlier quotes that I read was, political polarization often or also magnifies the power of the executive branch. When Congress does not act, the executive often steps in. Have we seen anything in history like this? Or is there the general belief that if there was an unwanted or legally questionable executive order, that Congress might act to do something about it through legislative maneuvers?
So in theory, that's entirely possible. And scholars really do think that Congress kind of serves as an effective check on the president not doing too many executive actions. The reason we don't have a lot, I mean, there are historical examples, it's just we don't have a lot of them because it's pretty rare that in order for Congress to pass a law overturning an executive order, the Congress would have to pass the law in such a way that the president couldn't veto it, right? So it has to have a veto-proof majority in Congress in order to overturn the president, which is relatively a rare event that he would have that many people opposed to what he's doing. So that doesn't mean that the Congress doesn't ever check the president. We have a lot of other ways that Congress can kind of push back on the executive's action, right? So Congress and the president aren't just dealing with each other on this one dimension of executive orders or not, right? They're dealing with each other on all kinds of legislation that's pending or that the president wants to get accomplished. So there can be repercussions in other dimensions for a president that does something Congress doesn't like. There can also be administrative appointments, right? That the president really wants so-and-so to lead an agency, And Congress says, well, you didn't play ball with us on that executive order. We didn't like it. So, no, you don't get your appointee of choice. Or really just a lot of where we see this is in greater oversight. So more hearings from the Congress on the president on particular issues that they're not happy about.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about the executive branch and the legislative branch. Has the judicial branch become involved in executive orders? I'm aware of the one time early in President Trump's administration when they said that immigration executive order is not fully legal in the way that it's written. And so I believe it was rewritten to pass their examination. But if I'm right or wrong, please let me know. Are there other instances where the judicial branch has become involved at the Supreme Court level?
Yes. Okay. So I'll talk about generally the court framework for thinking on executive actions, and then I'll come back to your question about the immigration, the travel ban orders. So generally, when the courts have gotten involved, especially the Supreme Court level with these executive order cases, they've reaffirmed the president's power to do this, right? This is something that the court is generally comfortable with. Presidents can issue executive orders. So the question then becomes, when do they kind of cross the line? And the court says, okay, we said you could do this, but not that. And so one famous example is an example with President Truman, right? And so what he did is there were steel workers about to go on strike. And he was really worried, this was the time of the Korean War, that the steel mills were going to shut down and it would hurt the war effort. So there was going to be a labor issue, basically, over steel. And so he used an executive order to try to seize those steel mills, which were private property. This went all the way to the Supreme Court. And a sort of landmark decision that's still cited to this day, the court ruled against the president and said there's no congressional statute that gives you the authority to seize private property in this way. So the court famously checked Truman, and he had to not do that through executive order. And partly the thinking was that the president is commander-in-chief, but that commander-in-chief power does not extend to labor disputes. So that is an example that, yeah, absolutely the court will tell the president when they think he's overstepped. That happens time and again, right, that courts will kind of call balls and strike with respect to individual orders when they're litigated, again, mostly siding with the president. Fast forwarding to the Trump orders in 2017, what happened was a sort of series of actions, two executive orders followed by a presidential proclamation. The first two were not struck down by the first was struck down by a lower court. The second executive order that the administration issued subsequently took a hit from another court. And then there was a presidential proclamation. So what happened in that is the policy itself was changing, becoming much narrower than the president had originally hoped for. The court did actually uphold Trump's presidential proclamation at the end, but the president did not get the ideal policy he wanted over the travel ban. Generally, what we saw with the courts in treating Trump's executive actions beyond just executive orders was a sort of tough treatment by the courts on Trump's actions. According to the Center for Policy Integrity that tracked these things, the Trump administration lost 80% of cases, which is pretty rare for a president. Most presidents, when they go to court over actions their executive branch has taken, tend to win. So that was kind of maybe an outlier when we think about the court's role in overseeing the president.
So you mentioned, I think the phrase you used was famous executive orders. So I wrote a couple down out of a list. President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was an executive order. Roosevelt's Japanese-American concentration camps for World War II, the Warren Commission for the Kennedy assassination, the pardon for President Nixon, the creation of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, the closing of Guantanamo Bay, and then, as we already talked about, the travel ban. Those were all done by executive order. I found that to be surprising.
There can be major policy actions that are done by executive order. Most of them, again, are pretty mundane in nature. They're things that, like, really are just somebody managing how an organization works. But there occasionally are these ones that you can just go and find that are really banner things that last throughout history. Absolutely.
We're our last 5 minutes or so with Professor Rachel Potter from UVA's Department of Politics. Professor, I read in the news where Oklahoma has passed a bill in the House, not throughout the state, as far as I read at the time, to let the state declare President Biden's executive orders unconstitutional. So how does that work, or how would that work for one state to allow presidential orders that they don't like to be unconstitutional?
Yeah, so I find this kind of a funny action for a legislature to take. When I'm not a lawyer by training, but when I hear that, all I can think of is the nullification crisis. And we've already been down this road as a country, right? And so we know how it turns out. States aren't generally allowed to negate what the federal government does. But so that's sort of a legal point about it. But I think it's a strange action for the Oklahoma legislature to take, because if you actually look at the things that Joe Biden has done since he's signed more than 50 executive actions since he assumed the presidency in January. But most of these are related to the pandemic. He's direct and really, I would say, are, even if you don't agree with the direction of them, very much in his power as chief executive. So he told federal agencies to come up with guidance to help schools safely reopen. So he's directing his agencies to come up with this documentation, essentially. He told FEMA that they could expand reimbursement for National Guard troops for costs that they incur relating to COVID. He required federal employees to sign an ethics pledge at certain levels. He undid a lot of what Trump did. He rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, which again was an agreement. So these are things that don't affect Oklahoma directly, right? These are things that affect agencies or the federal government or maybe even indirectly us as citizens, but they're not directly targeted at Oklahomans in any way. So I read this action not necessarily as something where they're really plausibly going to be able to nullify what the administration is doing, but instead as a signal to the Biden administration that they are watching and that they certainly will litigate against any action that they see it where they see an opening. So I think this is probably something that will be resumed in the courts rather than on the legislative side. And so if I was thinking about what the Biden team is probably thinking in regard to this, I would suspect that they are making sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed on these executive actions and that they're sort of safely within their constitutional and statutory framework to withstand legal challenges.
So we've got about 2 minutes left. So really quickly, state governors can do executive orders as well. How is that different from a presidential executive branch executive action or executive order?
Yeah, I think on the top line level, it's pretty much the same, right? Governors can do issue orders within, again, their constitutional at the state level and statutory framework. Where we see some variation is in how states are set up. So some states are routinely sort of governed by one party and don't have a lot of turnover or pushback from the other party, then we think, well, the legislature might not be pushing back as much on the governor's ability. Other states like Virginia has a term limit for our governor. And we know that states with term limited governors issue fewer executive orders. So there's like some institutional variation that leads to kind of different interpretations of when and how these things are used. But overall, the framework is fairly similar.
Our guest today, Professor Rachel Potter, UVA's Department of Politics, where she's an assistant professor. Her most recent book, Bending the Rules, Procedural Politicking in the Bureaucracy, Bending the Rules. How many recalcitrant bureaucrats picked that up?
Hopefully not that many. We'll see.
Professor, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm fascinated to learn more with you on the air with us than by just listening to the occasional newscast through NPR. I found this a worthwhile hour, and I hope you'll come back with us sometime in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick. This was fun. I do, as I said, I love talking about executive orders, so happy to come back.
Well, I think you had my ear for the hour, and I hope you had everyone else's. And don't forget, you can go to the podcast at CVillePodcast.com if you weren't here for the whole hour, because you should have been. Take care, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at CVillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.